now.
And welcome to the SBK Crypto Podcast. 15 minutes of crypto fame.
My name is Charles Story. I'll be your host for the next 15 minutes. We're coming live. Well, scratch that. We're not going to do the 15 minutes. It's going to be something a little bit more special. I have a special guest with me. We're going to take as long as it takes. We're going to stop the clock. We're going to get down and dirty. We're going to really understand our guest today. We're going to go into the weeds, man. We're going to find out what's really going on, where it all started, what his motivations are, what scares him, what keeps him going, what keeps him motivated on a day-to-day basis. The guest on the show today is Miles Schneider. He's the CEO of EOS Aurora, the blog producer. He has an amazing story. So what we're going to do, Miles, if everything's cool with you, we're going to start at the beginning.
That's all cool with me. Let's do it.
Let's do it. So where did it all begin? Where were you born?
So I was born in Cleveland, Ohio. That's where I grew up. Lived there till I was 18, and then moved to New York City to go to school.
And how old were you when you moved?
I was 17, actually. I was a little young for my grade, so I graduated high school at 17, and then that's how old I was when I started college.
And when you were back then, like, what did you want to do? Like, what was your motivation? You're pretty ambitious guys. What did you want to do back then?
So I've gone through a bunch of different periods in my life where I thought I was going to do a bunch of different things. But when I was in high school, my friend and I started a music blog, actually. So this was back in the time of, like, you know, like 2008 to 2012, right, when, like, music blogs ruled the scene, especially for, like, hip-hop. They were just, you know, they were like a big part of music culture. I feel like nowadays, like, music blogs aren't as big because you have things like Spotify and SoundCloud, right, and people, right, discover their music in different ways. But back then it was kind of where people went. So we started a music blog called In Audio We Trust. We grew that to, like, pretty big. I mean, we had, like, readership from, like, you know, all 50 states, a bunch of different countries. We were doing playlists and articles and interviews and downloads. We put on a few concerts in Cleveland, where we, like, hosted artists to come in and play. And so there was a while where I thought I was going to go into the music industry. I was actually, like, really sure of it. But I think as time went on, I started to realize that, like, the music industry is one of those industries just like, fundamentally changing at such a fast pace. And I wasn't seeing as many opportunities there as I think I had originally envisioned. You know, the record business is different now. Like, for an artist, you get, like, a 360 deal with a record company now, and they're taking a cut of your touring, and your, you know, Spotify's not paying that much for streaming, and record sales are basically non-existent now. So it's a changing business. So I'm still really into music, but eventually kind of left that. And you know, was interested in film for a while. I worked for a company that was producing documentaries.
Let's talk about the music. So what made you want to start a blog? Because I'm also a fan of music.
I've never
started a music blog.
I think I was really passionate about music. I was really interested in music. And I was, like, I was that guy that people went to for, like, music recommendations, you know? Like, I was, like, making...
Do you play any music?
I played a little bit of drums growing up, but, like, I was never super talented with, like, actually playing instruments myself. But I was always really appreciative of music. And right. I really, like, enjoyed listening to live music. And I always, like, paid really close attention to lyrics when I was listening to music. So I was interested in, like, sharing that passion. And like I said, like, I was kind of among my friend group known as the music guy. I was always on top of it. I was always listening to new stuff. So it reached a point where I was like, my friend who I started it with, we were getting hit up by so many people to be like, what should we listen to? We were like, let's just put it online. And instead of just giving this music out to our friends, we'll give it out to everybody.
Yeah.
And then we kind of grew it from there where we'd do more, like, articles analyzing music and diving deeper into it, talking about it, things like that.
So what kind of kid were you back then? Like, what were you like? Were you kind of, because I had a few friends who were, like, really into music, like, you were describing, and they were kind of, like, introverted. They were away from everyone a little bit, had their headphones on. They didn't really want to engage with the social community back then. Was that kind of your vibe, or were you a little bit different? Like, what were you like?
You know, I was actually kind of like a nerd growing up, especially in, like, early high school. You know, I was super, super academic. Yeah, then as time went on, I think I, like, developed more of a social life towards, like, the latter half of high school. But I wouldn't have described myself as introverted. In fact, I'm pretty extroverted. But I definitely kind of compartmentalize. Like, there's times in my life where I'm super extroverted, love being in a crowd, you know, like, being, you know, at the center of things and talking and all that. But I do really value also my alone time. And I think in high school growing up, like, music for me was a lot about that. Like, sometimes when I would, like, you know, be home on a weekday, hanging out at night and just listen to like an album cover to cover or something. Like something that I think kind of gets lost today in like the Spotify world where it's all about singles, you know, and you can just sort of listen to music on demand and pick and choose. Whereas like I still really value that idea of like an artist putting out an album that's a complete piece and you listen to that cover to cover because that's how it's meant to be experienced.
I love that, dude. So after high school, after you finished that, what happened next? What was your next move? Did you continue with academia? Did you continue kind of learning, or like what was your next move? Because you moved out of the music blog. What was the name of that blog again?
It was called In Audio We Trust.
In Audio We Trust.
Yeah. So my freshman year of college, we actually sold it to another guy who, you know, we were kind of reaching a point where we were like, you know, we don't really want to continue with this anymore. So we sold the domain to another guy. I mean, we didn't make a lot of money on this at all, but there's another guy who kind of wanted to keep it going. So we sold it to him, and then he ran it for a while. And I think eventually it no longer exists. I went to the site the other day and it's no longer there, unfortunately.
So what college did you go to?
I went to Fordham University in New York City.
New York.
Yeah. So I went there and like you don't have to declare a major until you're, I think, like a junior. So the first like 2 years I was kind of taking general ed classes, figuring out what I wanted to do. And then eventually I gravitated towards economics. And to be honest, looking back, I'm not really sure why I chose that. I think I thought it would be a really useful thing to learn.
Yeah.
And in hindsight, it was in some ways. But yeah, so that around junior year, I started, you know, I decided to study economics, and that's what I was going for. And I was also studying Spanish, and so I decided to go study abroad in Argentina. And that's where crypto comes into the story.
Before we get into the crypto element of this, when did you finish up? So you did the freshman year of your college and then you decided it wasn't for you?
No. Okay, so sorry. I did freshman year of college and that's when I sold the music blog, but I was still in college throughout that whole time.
Okay.
And so I continued. I graduated like from a 4-year program with a...
All right, so you did the 4 years.
Yeah.
You did your time.
I did my time. I got this stamp.
Did you graduate with?
Economics degree.
Okay, and what like in the UK, you're in master's. What did you qualify with?
Oh, it's a Bachelor of Arts in Economics.
Bachelor of Arts in Economics.
Yeah.
Were your parents impressed?
Was it
important for them?
It was definitely important for my parents to like see me graduate from college. I think I think it's going to be interesting to see how this evolves as time goes on, because I think that we're kind of a generation that's realizing that like the price you pay, especially in the United States, for college versus what you ultimately get out of it is a little nonsensical, and so many people go into so much debt as a result of it. And there's so many options for education now that aren't about that. So I think that like for our kids, it's going to look a lot different in terms of how they get, you know, higher ed or how they ultimately choose to learn things.
I think unless you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer, it's not really worth it. I really believe if you don't know what you want to do, and I think I know a lot of people who don't know what they want to do, and they go to university or college for you guys just to do something and hold that back. And I think you'd be better off just trying different things. So
I agree. I mean, if you don't know what you want to do and you have the opportunity and you can get a job, I say go abroad, go travel, move to a big city, go work somewhere. Try and get some experience to you know, do something interesting. I don't think going to college because you don't know what to do is actually the right move. It's just too expensive, and I think it's not worth it. And there's other options. I mean, if you're really ambitious and you want to get a super good paying job, you can go to one of these like online coding schools learn how to program and get really good jobs as a result of that. So
I agree. So what did you want to do after you finished college? Did you have an idea? Or were you trying to find out who you were and what you wanted to do?
I mean, I think I had gone through so many different periods of my life where I was thinking I wanted to do one thing and then ultimately realizing I wanted to do something else. And I think that kind of continued throughout college, really until I found crypto.
Where did you find crypto?
So my junior year, second semester of junior year, I moved to Buenos Aires to study abroad.
Okay.
And I was studying econ there. And I got invited to a dinner with a friend that I had known there who was an older expat who was living in Buenos Aires, and he invited my friends and I to dinner, and we went out to dinner, and I sort of by chance happened to sit next to this guy, Fede Muron, who is the CTO of Zappo, which is one of the biggest Bitcoin companies in the world. I mean, they're the Fort Knox of Bitcoin. They're one of the most respected custodians out there. And this is like 2014, so Zappo wasn't a super big company,
right.
But the founders are from Argentina. And I think I had heard about Bitcoin before, probably like reading about Silk Road on Reddit or something like that. But I had never, it had never really clicked with me until I had that conversation at dinner. And I just remember like that was really an aha moment. And I think a lot of people in crypto have their like aha moment or their rabbit hole moment or whatever. And that was it for me. So that conversation at dinner just compelled me to go do a ton of research. And having studied economics and having studied like Austrian economics especially kind of allowed me to understand that vision for crypto pretty quickly.
It's interesting you say that, 'cause a lot of the guys at the Roger Viz the world or the Jimmy Songs of the world, they all have a fascination with left-wing Austrian economists, and it's really kind of the basis and the ideas of this revolution from there. So were you a big reader of that once when you're studying economics?
So I actually didn't have almost any exposure to that in my economics classes in college. Wow. Like in most university economics, that's not something you encounter. It's not very common to like learn the Austrian school. I mean, maybe at certain schools they have more of that, but certainly not where I was. But I had a family friend who was like an old school Ron Paul libertarian gold bug. Yeah. And he gave me this book called The Creature from Jekyll Island. And that book is all about like how the U.S. Federal Reserve was started and how it works.
Right.
And he was kind of beating that drum for a long time and got me into it. And when I read that book, I mean, I came to the conclusion that I think a lot of people in this space come to, which is that like, you know, government management of the money system is largely a sham and leads to a lot of problems. And so, you know, that book was more from the people who were like sort of like gold standard type of people. But obviously a lot of that ends up translating into crypto.
That's amazing. Yeah. So after that dinner that happened, what took place? I mean, it was an aha moment.
Yeah.
But was it like, all right, this is all I need to do now. Like drop everything else. I've got my calling in life. Let's go.
I don't think it happened immediately after that dinner, but certainly after that dinner, I went home and like stayed up all night reading. Right. And over the next few weeks, sort of really discovered what this thing was all about. And kind of, you know, I found Bitcoin Talk. I found all the subreddits and all that. And, you know, I don't know at what point it was sort of like, okay, this is what I have to do. But I think it did reach a point where I was like, nothing else is this interesting to me that I'm going to spend this much time on it. So like, this is what I got to focus on for now.
And what was it that was really of interest to you? Like, what got you? Was it the, what element of, was it blockchain? Was it the idea of decentralized money in a sense? Like, what was the idea that was just like, for you, it just made perfect sense?
I think for me, it was definitely the money thing that started it. Right. Like this idea of like the separation of money and state and saying like, money really shouldn't be controlled by a government, but should just be a peer-to-peer agreement among all the people who are using it. And if we can make that decentralized and no one controls it, that's even better. So that idea really resonated with me. But I think there was also like this is like early 2014 and then going into like mid 2014. And this was also when like a lot of the first like altcoin quote unquote projects came about. So I did discover Bitcoin and kind of went really deep there, but ended up seeing some of these other projects that came online that were doing other interesting stuff with this technology. Okay. And I think that's when I was like, okay, there's a lot more that goes even beyond this that you can do.
So after Bitcoin, was it the altcoins or was it Ethereum or?
So no, it was actually the first project that I really got into outside of Bitcoin was BitShares, which was Dan Larimer's first project. And so Dan was, so BitShares had already started this in 2014 and I kind of came in kind of towards the beginning of that project, but there was already a community and people working on it and all of that. But, I think, I discovered Dan's writing through a friend that was also into crypto. Was like, hey, you got to check out this project. And Dan's early writing was very influential on me in terms of how I thought about crypto projects. So like, you know, he came up with delegated proof of stake, which I thought was a very interesting model to sort of accelerate the scalability side of things. And it had really interesting game theory properties. And then the other thing was that Dan was the first person to invent the concept of like a DAO. He called them DAX back back in the day, like decentralized autonomous corporations. And that was super interesting to me, like envisioning these networks as decentralized corporations and how you could get like, you know, efficiency out of that, and how you could get scalability out of that. And so that really influenced my thinking a lot. And I just ended up diving really, really deep on BitShares. But there were a couple other interesting things about BitShares that were kind of relevant to what I had seen. And the main one was that decentralized stablecoins. So BitUSD was really the first decentralized stablecoin. And when I was living in Argentina, they had they've had multiple currency crises over there over the course of history in that country. But in 2013, 2014, they had a big devaluation. And so I was living there, and like I would go and take dollars and just buy like pesos on the street. And everyone there wanted to save in dollars, and they could only buy a certain amount like legally through the banking system to hold dollars. So a lot of people would just go and buy dollars and keep them in a bank or keep them in like a mattress and like hold physical cash because that's what people wanted to save in. So I discovered Bitcoin, and there was a lot of interest there because people were like, you know, screw the pesos, screw the Argentinian government and their currency. Like, we want something else. So this idea of like a non-government controlled currency was very interesting. But Bitcoin was also even more volatile then than it is now. And it didn't make sense for people to like throw all their money in Bitcoin because that could potentially devalue more than the peso. So this idea of like, all right, combine the properties of Bitcoin with the value stability of dollar. And I saw where there was so much demand for dollars in some of these economies. And so that was like a really important aha moment for me.
So how did it make you feel being part of it, living there, and being part of a devalued currency situation? Because you're not looking from the outskirts, you're in it.
Yeah.
Like your day-to-day life is now like inclusive of all these different changes and people that you're associated with and feeling this. Like how did that affect you as a person?
I mean, I felt very lucky to be from somewhere that had a currency that had managed to maintain a pretty good amount of value. And I felt lucky to, you know, I went there, you know, I saved up prior to going there and I brought dollars with me. And that actually gave me like a lot more spending power than I would have had otherwise, right? Because the exchange rate is such.
Yeah.
But I think seeing it from like some of my Argentine friends who like, you know, they had jobs there and they were earning pesos and like they could... they could get by fine living in Argentina, but like they couldn't travel abroad because they're just the exchange rate was so not in their favor that they wouldn't be able to, you know, spend elsewhere or like afford things abroad. So that was really sad. You also saw how just like the government's attempts at like currency controls, they were super ineffective because people ended up routing around them. Like people were like, this isn't working for us. Like it's inconvenient to go buy dollars, but we're going to do it. And then you see other things just like how they were, you know, they were unable to import a lot of stuff. So like the grocery stores didn't have like very much of a selection, and some of the stuff that people wanted access to, like things that were produced abroad, they just didn't have access to. And you see how that sort of slowly affects a country in a lot of ways. So it made me realize, I think, you know, a lot of people from the United States, they don't understand this like reason to have money that's not controlled by a government because our currency has been pretty solid throughout, you know, at least people around our age, we've never had to experience that. But then you go somewhere else and you see it and you're like, okay, this is not the norm in a lot of other places. So we need to come up with solutions because people were suffering as a result of it.
That's incredibly insightful. And obviously that's a huge inspiration, having seen that and really knowing the power that this brings.
Yep.
But my question really is, like, what were you up to in Argentina? Like, you were working there. What were you doing? Were you hanging out? Like, what was the agenda?
So, well, I was studying abroad.
Right.
So I was going to school there. I was taking classes, but like, you know, I had classes, I think like 3 or 4 days a week. I was really I really wanted to learn Spanish. I had like taken some Spanish classes, so that was actually a big focus. And that was one of the most valuable things I got out of it was learning Spanish. But a lot of time was just spent like, you know, exploring the city and you know, I met a ton of people. There was a huge expat community there.
Yeah.
And I think going and living in other places is extremely valuable in terms of what you learn about, you know, other cultures and, you know, different ways of life and like the little nuances that make certain cultures the way that they are. And so like I learned some valuable stuff in my economics classes that I was taking, but like the real valuable learnings were like learning about like that culture and living in that place and really experiencing like what the economy, like how the economy actually functioned by going on the ground and like going and purchasing pesos on the street and that kind of thing.
That's insane, dude, because there's really three things going on here. One is you're studying abroad.
Yep.
The second is that you're witnessing a collapse of currency on a day-to-day basis. And the third is that you've found BitShares and you're already beginning your crypto journey.
Yep.
Like with all things, like I know you well enough, Miles, to know that you don't just do one thing. You have a few things going on. I mean, it's a lot of different things really going on there.
Yeah.
Like, to focus just on one is hard enough. And you've got three things going on there. So what happened next? What was the next part?
So the next part was that I ended up coming back from study abroad and went kind of straight into my senior year because of the way the semesters are scheduled. Since it's the Southern Hemisphere, like we didn't finish school until like July. So came back and went into my senior year, and like I said, I was studying economics, and I was in like an honors program where I had to write a senior thesis, and that was completely open ended. It just had to be involved in economics, and I was like, all right, I'm absolutely going to write this about crypto because I want to spend the next year like deep diving on crypto. So throughout my senior year, I worked on a thesis that ended up being really about like crypto and its use cases in developing economies,
right.
Either developing economies or economies that were experiencing high levels of inflation. And so I spent a lot of time studying like, you know, Argentina, Venezuela, countries like that where they were experiencing high inflation, but then also countries like areas in Southeast Asia or in Africa where like mobile phone penetration had like outpaced landlines,
right.
And areas where you could theoretically see, where there wasn't a lot of banking available, like people didn't have bank accounts, so they didn't have savings accounts, and all of the problems that caused, and how in certain places in Africa, people were saving in jewelry and cattle and things that were totally susceptible to all sorts of things going wrong. And yet mobile penetration was increasing in those places. So you kind of saw this vision for like, okay, so if we could have crypto that really functions as like mobile native and can sort of replicate some of the functions of a bank, which was for a lot of people the vision for BitShares, then it was like we can kind of get more financial inclusion, get people into this like digital era, get them participating in the internet economy in really interesting ways. So that is what I spent sort of all of my senior year doing, like studying and then eventually writing that thesis and defending that thesis. And so for over the course of that year, I was super involved in the crypto world, mostly in BitShares. That was a project I was most interested in. But this was like also the time when like Ethereum was beginning.
Right.
And so like Vitalik was originally a writer, I think, for Bitcoin Magazine.
Yeah.
I was like reading all of his articles. Like I was like, oh, this guy's super interesting. So followed along with Ethereum quite closely, but never like dove into that project in the way I dove into BitShares because I was more interested in like the scalability side of things, but certainly paid close attention. So then over the course of my senior year, I was kind of like, okay, this is what I want to do. This is what I'm sort of most interested in professionally. But it was also like the bear market of the crypto winter of 2014, 2015. So I had gone all in on crypto as soon as I found out about it and just watched things like on paper go down and down and down. But also there just wasn't as many like working opportunities at that time. So as I was approaching graduation, I was thinking like, you know, do I want to try and get a job in this space? And if so, what's that going to look like? So, I think I kind of remember that Coinbase was hiring and I was like, you know, maybe I'd go to SF or was entertaining the idea of maybe trying to go to Berlin because there seemed to be a lot happening there. But like overall, it was nothing like what we saw in like 2016 and 2017 where there was just a lot going on and a lot of opportunities. Upon graduation, I actually decided to take some time to do something that was totally not related to crypto, but that I had wanted to do for a long time, which was I really like to cook, and I come from a family. My mom used to be a chef, and food is just
What does she cook? What was her?
So she was a caterer, but like her specialty is like everything. Like she's really into like experimenting. Like when I was growing up, she would always get like Cooks Illustrated and Bon Appetit and cook these crazy recipes, and like I was totally spoiled because I didn't realize that like not everyone like had like a mother who would cook them like, you know, Chinese food one night and like Italian the next night and stuff. So, but that was a big thing with our family, and I always really enjoyed cooking. So, I I'd wanted to sort of explore that more and do something with that. And I was also really interested in going abroad again. So after graduation, I ended up moving to Mexico to do some cooking for a while.
Whereabouts in Mexico were you based?
So I first went to Mexico City and went to a cooking school there for like 6 months. And then after I finished that program, I moved to Tulum, Mexico to work at a restaurant.
What was your specialty? What was your killer dish?
So I have always had a fascination with Mexican food. Yeah. Like, I just think it's such an interesting cuisine. The history behind it is fascinating. The complexity of it is fascinating. The number of ingredients, and just growing up, that was my favorite food. Like, if you would ask me, like, where do you want to go eat? It was always Mexican food. So I was like, I'll go learn that. So the program that I went to in Mexico City was actually, it specialized in Mexican food, and we kind of went region by region and learned about the different cuisines. So that, in a sense, kind of became my specialty.
And are you a big fan of Spanish food?
I am a big fan of Spanish food, but I don't know as much about it as I do, for example, about Mexican food.
Because there's a blend, as you were saying before, there's a blend between the two.
Yeah, so it's kind of funny, because if you were to go to like Barcelona and, you know, go to some restaurants, you'd have absolutely amazing food. But if you were to go to Mexico, you would have absolutely amazing food that's very different, and you wouldn't necessarily see the direct parallels. But like, when you learn about the history, which is the Spanish coming over, bringing a lot of things from Europe, mm-hmm. and then you know, conquering Mexico, and then they ended up getting a lot of influence from what had existed there with like the natives and their different cuisines, and especially the ingredients in Mexico, because Mexico is just one of the most biodiverse places in the world. I mean, like, there's corn comes from Mexico, I believe beans come from Mexico, chilies come from Mexico, so all these things that you blended those, and then it kind of evolved from there, and you ended up getting this really like amazing cuisine that's got all sorts of complexity and all sorts of like I think, you know, different things going on. So yeah, it was very cool.
So how long were you doing that for? And at that point, was it more I want to learn more about food, or was it that I now want to be a chef? Like, that's my calling, that's my passion. This is what I want to do.
So believe it or not, I actually was like, I was paying close attention to crypto the entire time I was in Mexico, and I was still very interested in it. And I think my idea originally was, I'll go to the 6 months of cooking school in Mexico, then I'll move back and I'll get a job in crypto. And I ended up being down there and I was having a blast and I was loving cooking. And I, you know, after going to cooking school, I was like, you know what? I think the best way to really learn is to go work in a restaurant. And so that's what I decided to do. But it was always with the intention of sort of doing it as a temporary thing, to because I wanted to just learn and get better at cooking. And it ended up being, I mean, working in a restaurant is like the best way to learn how to cook really well, because you're doing it all day, every day. And so I was in Mexico City for 6 months and then Tulum for 8 or 9 months working at the restaurant.
What happened after that? And while you were cooking, were you also kind of keeping up to speed of what's going on in the market? Or was it you were just kind of laser focused on your new kind of day-to-day obsession? What was going on? Like, what were you up to within that in your mind? What was going on in your head at that kind of time?
Well, so when I was in cooking school, I had a lot more time, like, on the side to still pay attention. You know, I was always on the forums, and like, I remember specifically that, like, you know, watching Ethereum come online, and then Augur was like the first ICO that I had heard about ever. And like, I thought that project was really interesting. And I remember being in Mexico and reading about those projects and following along pretty closely. When I ended up working at the restaurant, restaurant hours are crazy. I was working like 12, 13 hour days all the time. So it was more of like a nights and weekends thing. But my goal there was really just to continue to follow along and like make sure I didn't fall too far behind and kind of see what was happening, because the space, even though it was like the bear market, was progressing a lot. But I would say my focus when I was there was definitely more on cooking. You know, it's like I'd gone from this digital world where I like lived on my laptop all the time and was on these forums to like doing this incredibly like sensory, tactile thing in cooking, where you're using all of your senses and using your hands and stuff. So it's like opposite side of the spectrum. But I really enjoyed it. So yeah.
So bring me up to speed. So how long were you doing that for?
So overall, I did that for like a little less than a year and a half.
What happened after that?
So I ended up, I came back to the United States because I actually got really sick and I had to come back. And so I was just sort of hanging out, recovering for a while. I ended
up... What happened?
I got a parasite.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Just, I think, at like I was actually, after I worked at the restaurant, I was traveling, and I was in Oaxaca, kind of a rural area. Wow. And I think I drank some water that was not like purified or something. So it was pretty intense for a while.
Painful.
Very painful. Yeah. Oh. So I came back and I moved back to, California, where my parents are living, and, ended up working for a like food related startup there for a little bit. Like I knew a guy who was just, who was actually, this hat is from there.
Let's describe the hat a little bit. What does it say on the front?
It says Macienda.
Macienda.
So this was a company that was, importing heirloom products from Mexico for chefs in the United States. And I had met the guy who founded it, and it was just him. So I came on board and kind of helped him, like grow that business a little bit, scale it up. And you know, I was trying to like lay low and just like get better, because I had gotten pretty sick for a while. And so was helping him out with that. But was like really kind of thinking like, okay, you know, this will be kind of a temporary thing that I'll do, and like let's figure out a way to dive into crypto full time.
Wow. What year is this now?
This is 2016.
2016.
Yeah.
Okay.
Through like early 2017. So, so I just started looking around and kind of trying to figure out what would be an interesting opportunity, in the crypto space. Like this was prior to EOS launching. So, Dan had gone from BitShares to Steam, and I didn't get quite as involved in like the Steam community as I had with BitShares, but I did think it was a very interesting project, especially like the token model with no transaction fees and trying to build this social network. And I was like, a little bit watching from afar. But then like 2017 happened, and as we all remember, like prices started going crazy. ICOs became like a much more common occurrence.
And you still were working at the heirloom startup?
So I left the heirloom startup, and then sort of right around that time, someone I had known from a few years prior in the crypto space introduced me to Kyle Samani and Tashar Jain, who at the time were about to launch Multicoin Capital. So he knew those guys from having lived in Austin, and they were in the process of launching a crypto hedge fund and were looking for someone who could do research. So I had a background in research through my senior thesis. And so I flew down to meet those guys and ended up hitting it off with them, and thought what they were doing is really interesting. And this is prior to Multicoin even being like a company or incorporated or anything.
This is the idea.
Yes, this was the idea phase. Yeah. So I joined them as the first employee at Multicoin and sort of led research efforts. So that was in the summer of 2017.
Did you move down to Austin, Texas at that time as well?
No, I actually was still in LA at the time. Okay. So for the first like 8 months that I was working there, I was working remotely from LA. I was going down to Austin pretty often, but I hadn't actually made the move there. I ended up moving in April of 2018.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So after the 8 month period, I mean, what were you guys looking at? Was it more, I guess, ICOs?
It was like we definitely weren't like an ICO fund. The idea was to like, you know, raise a fund that was like a crypto native fund investing in these assets. And we kind of made like research our mandate. So we wrote a bunch of like pretty in-depth reports about different projects,
yeah,
analyzed them, you know, tried to do like price models, things like that. Tashar comes from a more financial background, so he did a lot of that stuff, whereas I was more focused on just like core research. Multicoin, I was there for a while, and I had been following along with EOS from really day one. So it was announced in like May of 2017, and then there was the year-long token sale before obviously mainnet launch in June.
Yeah.
And so I was following that project from day one, just because I had known about like BitShares and you know, had really admired Dan and all that. So I was paying very close attention to that project for a long time. Within Multicoin, I was the guy who was always talking about EOS and how I thought it was really interesting. So we as a firm kind of began to pay a lot more close attention to that project, because I was so convinced that it had, you know, some of the most potential of anything out there. And you have to remember, this was a time when like people were super skeptical of EOS. Especially I think within the fund world, you know, we were like the only ones who were publicly saying this is really interesting. There was just a lot of people didn't understand it. A lot of people just had skepticism about the way the sale was structured, or you name it. But we really like went deep and saw what like what that technology could do. And I think for me, coming from a BitShares background, a lot of the ideas from BitShares ended up being incorporated into EOS. So that's how we like, you know, I kind of understood those pretty pretty closely. But we started doing like really in-depth research about EOS, and we published a few reports and articles and things like that.
And you were publishing reports not only on EOS but for Multicoin Capital kind of weekly. Right.
Yeah, we had some sort of content was coming out weekly, whether that was me or Kyle writes a lot of content, Tashar writes a lot of content. But we would do sort of like shorter form articles that could cover different topics, but then we'd do these really in-depth reports. Yeah. Like our EOS report ended up being like 20 something pages, I think, where we really tried to dive in, cover every aspect of it, like I think address a lot of the concerns that we saw within like the crypto community about like explain why this project was interesting, why the architecture made sense, why the approach made sense, why the trade-offs made sense. And we also wrote a report specifically about delegated proof of stake and like why that consensus model is really interesting.
So why is it interesting?
Oh man, I could talk about this forever. I think the most interesting thing about DPoS is that you end up getting So what you do is you kind of – decentralization is not a goal in and of itself. It's a means to an end. And the end is really like no single point of failure, censorship resistance, sort of resistance against attacks. And you can take one approach, which is like try and be as decentralized as possible and not care how it affects performance. Or you can take the DPoS approach, which is that you only go for as much decentralization as you need. But you also get a ton of performance as a result because you sort of lower the number of nodes that are producing blocks at any given time, and that allows you to cut down on latency, increase decrease the block time, increase the size of blocks, things like that. But you also have these properties where like token holders have very real checks on the power of block producers by the ability to vote them in and out. And there's a lot of game theory at play that keeps block producers honest because they want to get like being a block producer is a nice business if you can stay in there and you know get that perpetual set of rewards from producing blocks. And there's not a lot of incentive to misbehave because if you do, you'll either be voted out or it'll be totally ineffective. So that's one side of things. You get this kind of like scalability and security. And then I think what's really interesting about DPoS is that it incentivizes these block producers to bring value back into the ecosystem. So if you have something like proof of work, you essentially, if you can produce the hash power, you find the blocks and you add blocks to the blockchain. With DPoS, you have to earn the votes from the community. And to do that, you have to prove that you add value in any number of different ways. And you're seeing block producers do all sorts of different things to add value to the community. And they're doing a lot of stuff where they're like bringing value, giving things away for free, building tools that's helping the community accelerate really fast. And they're doing that in order to support their business, which is getting votes. So you've seen block producers who have, you know, built really amazing wallets and given those away for free. You're seeing block producers who are building dev tools. You're seeing block producers like Aurora who are really focused on education. You're seeing block producers who are really focused on community. And so you have EOS today is paying 80 different independent companies all over the world to work for the network and bring back value in all sorts of different ways. And I think you're seeing the results of that because it's allowing EOS to really sort of evolve faster than almost any other network out there.
I absolutely agree. And we've been up and running now for 5 months. So it's like still the really early stages for this. But I also believe that there'll be many protocols out there. What do you feel EOS is best suited for and why?
That's a good question. I agree with you that there's going to be different protocols. Like, I don't think it's a be-all, end-all game.
Oh, that'd be pretty centralized.
Yeah, it'll be totally centralized, yeah. Which is actually one of the reasons why I don't quite understand the vision that some people have for certain projects where it's like, this should be the only thing. But I think that EOS is specifically catered to use cases that I think are really high performance and are you know, at scale user facing applications. So some of the things that we've already seen, but like gaming makes a lot of sense on EOS because you're never going to have people paying for individual transactions on a game, and you can't have latency issues like you have with other blockchains. I think blockchain based social networks could be really interesting. Mm-hmm. People have tried this on Ethereum, but no one wants to pay gas on a retweet. So it's like, it's probably not going to work. I think that tokenized securities, fully on-chain decentralized exchanges, which are actually possible with something as performant as EOS, NFTs, those are, I think, are going to be the use cases that we see sort of early on. And I know that this is a like bit of a hand-wavy answer, but I think there are a ton of things that we can't conceive of yet that people are going to build on top of this, like crypto-native business models. You know,
social network.
A social network could be one. I mean, I think we're seeing like, right now on EOS, we're seeing a lot of these gambling dApps take off, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's, you know, gambling has kind of been a consistent theme in crypto. It's like one of the early use cases. But specifically what we're seeing on EOS is people build these like for-profit dApp businesses built on top of a blockchain. And I think that's fascinating. Like entrepreneurs will be attracted to EOS because they can build these crypto-native business models and have the performance that allows them to get a lot of users. And there's certain things about EOS that just make it that much more catered to everyday users. Yeah. So you've got human-readable account names. You've got account-specific permissions that can be sort of configured on the back end to give users a ton of security. You have people that don't have to pay individual transaction fees, which is like just from a mental standpoint, that's really important. Even if you have really, really low transaction fees, I think people don't like paying fees. So those are like some of the things that I think will allow EOS to, you know, gain mass adoption before almost any other smart contract platform out there that I can see.
And with regards to the other smart contract platforms out there, and there's obviously there's Ethereum, but there's also others like Definity, but you know, they haven't come to market yet, so we already have a conversation about that. But what is your view with where we're currently at? Because we're 5 months into this, are you happy with the progress? And having followed EOS since the very early stages, you really have a good understanding of the tech. Are you happy with where we're at? It's been a bumpy ride for the start. The community launched it, and it was kind of delayed, and we had a few setbacks. Yep. But are you happy with the progress what we're making at the minute?
Yeah, overall, I am happy with the progress. I mean, you've seen, so for example, if you compare it to Ethereum, like Ethereum has had one, they started with proof of work. So the performance of Ethereum hasn't changed at all since the time it was launched. Whereas if you look at EOS, you know, we've had block producers be able to work together to upgrade the limit when we go into congestion mode, which allows users to get more CPU. We've seen optimizations to the resource algorithm. We've seen optimizations to WASM that have resulted in performance. So we're only 5 months in, and we're actually more performant now than we were at mainnet launch. And there's a bunch more stuff that's in the pipeline that's going to help with that, like multi-threading and side chains and things like that. So I think from that perspective, I'm very happy with the progress. I think the next major challenge that the EOS community is going to face, and we're going to see this become, I think, the dominant theme over the next few months, is structuring governance. Because that's really one thing that hasn't been formalized and defined in a proper way yet. So we've got a referendum contract that's being built that will allow us to conduct a public on-chain vote referendum. And that is going to allow us to ratify a new version of the Constitution, which means we have to decide what's included in the Constitution. We have to decide how arbitration is going to function. We have to decide worker proposal system. Is that something we're going to have on chain or no? And I think those are challenges that are different from the technical challenges, right? Like technical challenges, we've got some of the most brilliant technical minds working on EOS, and they've been amazing. I mean, there's a lot of block producers out there who've done an amazing job of helping get the performance of the chain much better. But that's working with like hardware and like code, right? And then there's this idea of what people call wet code, which is more of the human side of things and the governance side of things. And that's a really tough challenge. And I think EOS is lucky that right now, you know, we're in a bear market. The community is still pretty small, and we have the opportunity to figure these things out and get it right before the masses come in. Mm-hmm. Because if people start piling into EOS and the market cap skyrockets and the general crypto market goes crazy, it's going to be a lot harder to solve these issues. Mm-hmm. So I think we really need to focus on those right now while we're sort of in this market lull, get those things right, and then, you know, poise EOS to get mass adoption, because
on the technical side of things, I'm very confident that EOS is going to be ready for that when the time comes. On the governance side of things, I think there's still a lot of work to do.
Well, it's interesting, the concerns that you've raised there, and I think they're very valid. But I'd be interested in your thought on this. So I heard the other day that the Ethereum, I don't agree with this, by the way, but the Ethereum developer community is a lot stronger than the EOS. And I think that is a viewpoint with a lot of the community out there. What's your viewpoint from being in the front line and being involved in the day-to-day workings? Like, what are you seeing?
I think Ethereum has been around longer and probably has more overall developers working on it. But, like, these are super subjective things. Like, how do you determine the quality of developers? Or what is a developer community? You know, is just having more developers make you a better community? Or is it the quality of developers? There's a million things. And, you know, I'm not a developer, so I'm not super qualified to say that. What I do hear some people say, though, is that, like, that EOS doesn't have a developer community, or that it has a really weak developer community. And that is simply not the case. That's someone who's just choosing to ignore the reality on the ground or is too lazy to really look into it. I mean, I invite anyone who thinks that to come to one of these EOS hackathons or to, you know, go in the Telegram chats or the WeChats and you know, just talk to people. You know, ping me on Twitter and I'll introduce you to 10 developers who you can talk to about EOS.
What's your Twitter username?
@Miles_Snyder.
There we go.
Yeah. And so I think that there's an amazing developer community in EOS. Absolutely. So that is, you know, I'm very confident that that's the case.
That's great, dude. So let's get into the section we're in at the minute. EOS Aurora, where did that come from? You left Multicoin Caps. What was the reason behind that? What was the motivation?
So I was spending more and more time on EOS specifically. You know, I'd been following the project for a long time, but I ended up writing a series of reports, which was first the delegated proof of stake report, then the EOS report, and then, you know, a number of articles sort of in between there related to EOS in some way or another. So there was several months where I was almost exclusively focused on EOS. And I was, you know, I was meeting everybody in the community. I met other block producers. I talked to a bunch of developers. I talked to projects. I talked to people who were running proxies, other funds. And as time went on, I just realized that EOS was by far the most interesting project for me in the entire space.
Right.
And it reached a point where I was like, kind of in the same way when I discovered crypto and was like, I can't focus on anything else, I ended up getting really into EOS and was like, I can't really focus on anything else in the space because this is so interesting to me. So I was starting to think, like, how could I spend more time on EOS specifically, or even spend all my time on EOS specifically? And I've always had an entrepreneurial side. I think I always thought that I would do something entrepreneurial, and I didn't know what that was or when that would happen. But with EOS, I saw that being a block producer, I thought it offered a really interesting opportunity to be super involved in the EOS community, like do that as my full-time thing, and sort of build a brand in what I saw to be the most interesting ecosystem out there. And so I thought it would be really interesting. I thought it would be really challenging because we were doing it after the mainnet launch. We were definitely a late starter in the block producer community. But it was ultimately what I really wanted to do. I thought that, like, I was like, I need to focus on EOS. Well, what can I do in EOS that would be super interesting? And being a block producer was that.
So where did the name EOS Aurora come from? Like, what is the meaning behind that
word? Yeah. So, EOS or EOS is a Greek god, and Aurora is the Roman counterpart to the Greek god. That might be the other way around, but I think it's that way. I don't know if the EOS network had anything to do with this Greek god who is called EOS. But you know, I was sort of thinking about names and I came across that and I liked it. And it was funny. After I ended up launching, I realized the EOS Argentina guys started a testnet like many months before called EOS Aurora. So we're actually Aurora EOS, but they called theirs EOS Aurora. And I had no idea that even existed. I like missed the Steemit post where it was announced. But I just sort of I liked that name and I thought it was interesting because it was related to EOS in a cool way, and I ran with that, and I the designer that I hired came up with a really cool logo that I really liked, and I was like, all right, this is it, let's do it.
That's amazing, dude. So let's talk about BPs. As you mentioned, BP, block producer.
What is the role of a block producer on the network, and why is it important?
So a block producer is being a block producer on EOS is you are a company that provides infrastructure as a service to the network. And in order to do that, you need to be voted in by token holders. So you are elected into the position of providing infrastructure to the network, and you are elected into that position conditional on you bringing value and being honest and doing good things for the community, and you can be voted out by the community if you don't do that. And so you have all these independent companies all over the world that are doing this in different ways. And what it comes down to is it's a two-sided business. The first side of the business is you have to run the infrastructure to sort of produce blocks, run a full node, you know, run APIs, all of that. And then the other side of the business can be really anything that gets you votes. So you've seen block producers take different routes. Like I was saying before, some are really, really focused on building tools. Some are focused on building dApps. Some are investing in dApps. There's a lot of different ways that you can prove value to the community. And I actually think EOS benefits a lot from having different groups of block producers that specialize in different things, right? You don't want every block producer building a wallet or a block explorer or whatever it may be. You want a few who can build great infrastructure, a few who build great dev tools, a few who are community focused and all of that. So when we were building Aurora, you know, I spent a lot of time just having conversations with people in the community. And I think consistently, especially from people who weren't like core EOS community on Telegram all day long, there's a lot of people who were like, you know, we like EOS, we think it's interesting, but we have trouble following along with it. We don't know what's going on. You know, it's a very complicated project. There's a lot of different facets. And so I realized there is an opportunity to really focus on education, because that would allow us to bring more people into the EOS ecosystem, get them more involved. And specifically with EOS, it's an on-chain governance blockchain. So you have token holders can actually participate in governance. And if we want the network to function really well and we want the governance process to be healthy, then people need to be informed about what they're making decisions about, whether that's voting for block producers or participating in referenda or whatever it may be. So our goal is to create whether it's, you know, articles or podcasts like this, or you know, just interfacing with people on the different channels like Twitter and Telegram and WeChat. But we want to create content that helps people make informed decisions and really understand EOS, understand some of these issues and the complexities, like things, you know, around things like scaling and governance and things like that. And we saw an opportunity to make that really our focus while also having really strong infrastructure. And that's what we decided to do.
Well, it's interesting because you have a background in being able to communicate on paper and the blog formats. And it's interesting, we're back to the blogs again, because you got the music blog, and then for Multicoin, you're publishing some pretty cool blogs there as well, kind of focused around EOS and other protocols out there, but mostly about EOS.
Yep.
And now with Aurora, we find ourselves back in the blogs again, dude. I don't know if you've seen this pattern, but I think we're starting to see it pattern much.
It's come full circle.
It's come full circle. So you're doing weekly, because I receive them, weekly updates on what's going on in the EOS ecosystem, what you're seeing, and really bringing people up to speed. Is there any other facets of education that you're currently doing or currently looking to do?
Yeah, so we're doing a weekly newsletter that gives people a roundup of everything that's happening in EOS. So that's one way. Like, you know, if you have a full time job or doing something else and aren't like working in EOS, it can be really hard to stay up to date.
Even if you are full time,
yeah, even for us. But we try and have that weekly newsletter that allows people to sort of check in once a week and be like, okay, this is what's happening, and you know, if I want to read about these different things, there's all these, you know, links to do so. We're writing a lot of our own content, so we're trying to publish articles, you know, weekly, diving into different topics that we think are important for people to understand. You know, I'm definitely doing the rounds on a lot of different like podcasts and some YouTube shows and things like that, because I think that's another way to get the word out there. And you know, we're doing a lot of outreach on like Twitter and Reddit, and then, you know, WeChat, Bihu in China. So one of the nice things about having these written articles is that we can get those translated, get those out into the other communities that, you know, that aren't English speaking, and can still sort of get those ideas out there. You know, as much as I like love podcasts and things like that, this isn't going to reach the same, like, you know, the Chinese audience and the Korean audience and the South American audience and things like that.
So why is the Chinese audience in particular, I know the answer to this, but I want to hear it from your mouth, why is that so important?
So the, you know, EOS is one of the biggest projects in the blockchain space in China. And specifically there, you know, there's more activity around EOS happening in China than anywhere else. The amount of token ownership that exists out there is higher than anywhere else. The amount of developer activity, just the amount of interest is higher than anywhere else. I mean, China in, as a whole has a really huge crypto community. I mean, it's a huge country with a huge population, and they've been interested in crypto for a long time. But specifically, I think EOS has really taken off there. Yeah. And it is interesting because here in the West, I think a lot of us who were in the BitShares community were like perpetually disappointed that people didn't seem to be getting it. They didn't get the vision for it. Whereas BitShares actually took off a lot in China. BitCNY was an even bigger stablecoin than BitUSD. Wow. And people, you know, out there, people became involved in delegated proof of stake. Yeah. They understood the idea of voting for block producers and doing all that. So I think that translated into EOS really well. Yeah, there's just that much more activity out there. People in China have really understood the EOS vision and seen what is possible with this technology and are just, you know, they're building on it in really amazing ways. Where I think in the West, we still have a lot of catching up to do. A lot of crypto funds here in the US, and that's the world I come from, they don't yet understand the vision for EOS,
right,
and they're having trouble grasping it. So, you know, we're trying to do a lot of educational work to, like, get all those people up to speed. But, you know, we're also trying as much as possible to get out there to the Chinese community because that's where so much is happening. I mean, you look at the top dApps on EOS right now, most of them are from Chinese teams. So they're doing it. They're doing an awesome job of building on EOS.
That's what we like to see.
Yeah.
And like any great protocol out there, what it needs is cool stuff being built upon it.
Absolutely.
People adopting it, people having fun, people trying new things and really pushing and growing it. So what excites you most at this current point in time? What excites you most about EOS? What's got you ticking? What has you waking up in the morning and doing what you do? The smile that you have on your face right now, what keeps you going?
There's a few things. I think one is the community. Yeah. Like every time I come to one of these events, like the hackathon, I'm just blown away by like the enthusiasm, the intelligence of people who are working on these projects. I mean, the technical expertise. And you know, I've just made such great friends in the crypto community through EOS, and there really is this amazing group of people that not just includes all these block producers, but also a ton of different developers who are building, investors like you guys who are seeding projects and things like that. So the community gets me really excited, but I think the thing that excites me the most is the progress we're seeing around usability and around dApps. So you've got dApps, as I mentioned before, that are actually building crypto native business models. I think that is fascinating because I think that's like what you saw in 2017 with sort of the ICO craze was people were like, okay, we can raise a ton of money through an ICO to go build something. And that's not necessarily the best model. Whereas what we're seeing now is people say, we can build a dApp that has a for-profit business model and make money doing that. And that's way more exciting. And when you can motivate people like that, you get creative entrepreneurs all over the world who are going to come up with different ways to build cool stuff. And what's even more important is you have an architecture because of the way that EOS is built that can support those use cases. So you can actually get users to come and use these and come back and not try it once and then quit because of high fees or latency or whatever it may be. And then on top of that, we're just seeing usability. So like the human readable account names, the key permission management system. I mean, I'm sure you've used some of these EOS wallets like EOS Links or Token Pocket or Meet.one that are like, the other day I was just wowed because I went and I transferred some tokens to a mobile wallet. I bought some RAM. I staked some resources. I voted for block producers. I played a game and won some tokens. And then I sold those tokens on a DEX and I never left the app.
Wow.
It's amazing. Wow. And like all of my key management took place within the mobile app, but I was able to navigate to these different dApps and use my account on those. Yeah. And it was all from within this one single app. Yeah. And I think that is truly amazing. And we're, like we said, we're 6 months in. I mean, 5 months, I guess. So seeing that progress on usability is really, really exciting to me.
That's amazing, dude. And before we just wrap up, the reason we're together overlooking San Francisco from the hotel is because we're here for the hackathon. How have you found the hackathon here in San Francisco? How's the vibe been? You're also at the one in London. How do they compare? What is your view on what's going on at the minute down there?
Yeah, absolutely. So the EOS Hackathon in London was like the best crypto event I have ever been to by far. Everything about it was great. I mean, the enthusiasm, the venue, just the way it was set up. Block One did an awesome job with that. And we're seeing that in San Francisco too. I mean, I think the levels of enthusiasm are what you really what really sort of motivates you. You know, you're seeing so many people who have all these different ideas and they're so excited and they're like ready to stay up all night building. And the topic that we have for this hackathon is pretty open-ended, which I think is kind of cool because we're going to see a lot of different people put forth a lot of different stuff. And it leaves the door open for all sorts of different projects to come forth.
Let's talk about the challenge. The challenge itself is build an EOS IO application that fosters a fundamental competitive advantage by implementing a business model that aligns interests among stakeholders and or drives more value back to users. So London, it was more about privacy, data control. This is really open.
It's super open.
Like anything can be built from this.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically saying create a crypto native business model that drives value to users or does something innovative and unique. So like I've talked to teams that are building games. I've talked to teams that are doing like sort of more like social network related stuff. But like I can't wait to see the pitches because I think we're going to see all sorts of things. I mean, there's no real like limits to where this could go.
That's amazing, dude. That's amazing. Well, listen, thank you so much for coming on the show today. And how can people contact you? How can people reach out? How can they find out more about Aurora? So like what should people do?
Yeah, absolutely. So at Aurora EOS BP on Twitter, AuroraEOS.com. You can find me on Twitter at Miles with a Y underscore Snyder with an I. At Aurora EOS on Telegram. We've got a Telegram group. Feel free to reach out there. Ping us on Twitter. Ping us on Telegram. Ping us on WeChat. All our information is on our website, so check it out there.
And how can people sign up for the newsletters?
So the newsletter, they can sign up through the website. There's a link right there. Just go to AuroraEOS.com and enter your email, and you'll get weekly updates from us about everything that's happening in the space. And you'll be able to cast a more informed vote on EOS.
All right. Thanks for coming on the show, man. Awesome.
That's a wrap. I got to bounce. Thank you for your time and attention, as always. And remember to join us on Telegram, SVK Crowd. Hit us up on Twitter at SVK_crypto. And feel free to email myself, cstory, C-S-T-O-R-R-Y, at svkcrypto.com. That's a wrap, and I got to bounce.
You've been listening to an SVK Crypto Podcast original. Follow us on Twitter at SVK_crypto. Email us on cstory@svkcrypto.com. Leave us a message on our website, www.svkcrypto.com.